Since the book Last Train from Hiroshima came out from Charles Pellegrino, it's been said that everything we thought we knew about Hiroshima was wrong. I don't know that in the end that proves to be true. Here's what I know. I knew nothing about Hiroshima. I mean, I thought I had. I'd read books about it. I remember doing a whole, 12-page footnoted research paper in high school on Hiroshima. And yet the information that Charles Pellegrino has in here, using a scientist's eye, almost examining the physics of the bomb as it exploded over Hiroshima and as people were affected by it, it'll change your life. Honestly, you'll never forget the word imagery of Last Train from Hiroshima. What's the significance of the title? We'll get into that coming up. And it would seem, although it seems like a very sort of pale use of the analogy here, but to use the popular metaphor, that Amazon is going for nuclear warfare over the iPad, the new Apple product that was released this week, and they are banning or blacklisting all books from Macmillan Books. And that includes Last Train from Hiroshima. Hasn't even made the news yet, but you'll hear about it next because Charles Pellegrino's book is right there being affected by it. We've changed the link on our webpage to barnesandnoble.com so you can get a copy of this. But we'll hear about what's happening, and then we'll explain why I said earlier that the bomb over Hiroshima is considered a dud. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Charles Pellegrino, let's start with what's going on with the book before we start with what's going on in the book, and thanks for agreeing to come on tonight.
All right. Well, basically, Apple has come out with this iPad, and one of the problems some publishers and a lot of authors have had is some of the other systems, which now look like not even Homo erectus, a hand axe, more like, way back before anything like, primitive artifact compared to the beauty of the Clovis Point. And the one thing that Apple is offering publishers is that it will be very difficult. They're putting as many guarantees as they can in that the concern of one copy of the book electronically being able to be cloned into thousands of copies. And so they've given that protection. And so they've got what seems like a superior product. And publishers like Random House and Macmillan have been saying, look, we're going to have our e-books with these guys. Well, Amazon is tied in with their Kindle program. And they decided to start punishing publishers, and they set up my publisher and its chain as an example, sort of like the Germans taking everyone out into the town square and taking about 10 people into the middle of the square as an example to everyone else, along with those 10 people's families, which is all the writers, and gunning them all down and saying, well, there's a lesson to you, Random House. Don't you cross us.
Right.
Don't try to blow up any more trains.
Right.
A lot of writers tonight are saying, well, we're not just going to blow up more trains. We're going to go straight for Pina Monday and blow up all your rockets, too. So a lot of people, John Batchelor being the first to get out there and call for a national boycott against Amazon.
What we know here is that they've listed a formal group of books that they're taking off. Target you specifically,
no,
just everybody by Macmillan and
all
okay.
authors that are under Macmillan. So Eli Wiesel's Night. I mean, we've got Nobel Prize winners whose books are being just banned from Amazon. Nobel Prize winners. Wait till Oprah hears about this. Several of her Oprah Book Club books are now banned from Amazon. Oh boy, she took on the whole meat industry in one.
Right. Well, at least fortunately, everybody can buy a copy at the link we put up.
Barnes & Noble, Books a Million, Borders, everyone can find copies of it there.
Okay. And so that one disaster averted. Has it been like 3 years since we've talked? Is that the last time we were on was talking about the the ossuary and the Jesus tomb and
that, has a lot happened in that subject. That's a whole other show.
But was that the last
really
time
confirmed that there was never a skeleton in the Jesus ossuary? Even Tinker now agrees with the science evidence on that. There were nothing but two shrouds that were placed in that ossuary ever.
But that's so interesting, though, that all of this time, that was the last time we spoke was on that, right?
Yeah.
That was the last? Okay. I can't believe it because I love having you on, so I don't want to make it be.
A lot of religious people who were screaming, you fools, Jesus isn't in that tomb. He's not in that ossuary. It's like, oh, boy, well, you know, yes, it is consistent what you guys said we scientists should have found.
Well,
only one metacarpal bone fragment, very hemispherical, and which former New York medical examiner Zugibi, he looked at that evidence and he said, you know, that is the only bone consistent with crucifixion. I'm like, you know, I need to get away from this for a while. I'm going to Hiroshima. Have fun.
Well, it is an amazing read, and it is only with a scientist's eye that I think you're able to tell this story fully for the first time. The Last Train from Hiroshima is Charles Pellegrino's new book, and it is, well, I want to start by just laying the groundwork just for people who don't know about what led up to Hiroshima, and then we'll talk about the actual incidents that you get into in such amazing detail in the book. But it's the tail end of World War II. The European theater is already conquered. Hitler has committed suicide. The Third Reich has surrendered, and there are literally tens of thousands of troops, of U.S. troops, that are being sent to the Pacific theater. Because they just know the casualty rate is going to be so high. And yet what nobody knew was that the government had been working on a secret weapon, the bomb. Talk about some of the events that were leading up that created the event that we know of as Hiroshima.
Yeah, it's an odd thing because when you look back to the timing of events, there was even a movie about the one event, Valkyrie,
right,
last year.
Right.
You know, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and around all explosive events, you have these shock cocoons. That's why, as we'll get into later, there was a man right under the atomic bomb in the basement of a building, and the whole building was shock cocooned and still standing there right across the river from the dome, right under the hypocenter, and the building was standing there, and he walked out alive. We had that same sort of event, probably history's most disastrous shock cocoon event. It happens around all explosive events. Was Hitler was standing right next to the bomb. There was a big, heavy beam next to where a bomb had been placed at a table in a meeting. Everyone else in the room was grievously injured or dead. And Hitler walked away shock cocooned because the force went around that beam. If he had been in the same line of the explosion and 20 feet further away, he would have been dead or unable to continue in the war.
6 inches to the left or six inches to the right. If that thick table leg doesn't protect Adolf Hitler, he's dead.
He's dead, and Germany surrenders the next day, and the Battle of the Bulge never happens. The Battle of Veer never happens. All these things that stretch the war on and on, Germany would have surrendered that day. The whole MacArthur campaign into Japan would have advanced more than 6 months earlier, possibly 8 or 9 months earlier. And about 2 months, what we had by the time of the Hiroshima bombings is it wasn't just a matter of Japan out there all clear, blue skies, and one day there were these two atomic bombs that brought about the surrender. We had been bombing for 6 months prior to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had bombed almost everything except Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 67 cities and half of Tokyo had already disappeared by the time of that bombing with these massive B-29 raids by firebombers.
So, these are incendiary bombs that were intended to shut down
firestorms.
Right. And but also most importantly to shut down the war machine, Japan's war machine itself, to demoralize the Japanese for wanting to continue to fight, but to stop them from being able to produce the goods, the fuel needed to keep fighting.
The country was starving. If the atomic bombs hadn't been used, the war probably would have ended. Hiroshima and Nagasaki would have been firebombed, and the war would have ended possibly as soon as 6 months later. The revolution within the Imperial Palace, no one knew about this, was on the verge of taking place at the time that Hiroshima was bombed. So if you move up these events, if Hitler had not been located in that shock cocoon and you move these events up all those months, it's better than a 50% probability that the war would have been over with Japan by the time that the Hiroshima by the time we did our first atomic test in July of 1945, the war with Japan could have been over.
That's a very interesting point.
At the time, the atomic bombs were considered just two more tools in the firebomb toolbox. So it was for decades, at least into the 1980s, people remembered what happened in Hiroshima, and it was kind of shock therapy for our civilization. It might, in a way, have created the longest strategic peace we had known up to through the Cold War, because it frightened people. Not even the scientists knew exactly what those bombs were going to do until they did it. In fact, only during the last year have we learned the evidence that the bombs actually created a microwave burst.
Yeah, well,
essentially, in addition to the gamma rays and the neutron spray, right, and what we recently discovered with heavy ions going through people, we have now found evidence that for about a third of a second, each city became a microwave oven.
And I want to get to that, but I want to make sure too that people understand, then again, about why Hiroshima and why Nagasaki. The belief is that, like a lot of these Japanese towns, the armories, the military bases, the factories that were producing the mechanics of war were all interconnected with communities. They were placed around large civilian populations. Isn't that the conventional wisdom of why this bombing would be taking place? They were targeting a center that the Japanese had strategically interwoven with civilian population, or is that not true?
Well, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they had the civilian population working. They turned the schools into factories. They convinced all the children that when the Americans come, they are going to rape and kill all the children. They are going to rape and kill all the women. And one child who survived was telling the story about how they were down to making these two-shot guns for the boys in the school, as young as eight. And they had demolished homes, and they had hardwood, and they were making the bullets that would shoot two bullets of mahogany. And it was decided that this is all you need. The Americans will shoot you before you get off more than two rounds. That's all you need. The girls were being taught to stab people with bamboo spears. A doctor had been recruited who survived, and he was being forced to teach young men and boys how to strap explosives to themselves and throw their bodies under American trucks and such. When you look at the Hitler Youth Movement, when you look at what the warlords were teaching the children in Japan, it's one of the most monstrous, massive cases of brainwashing and abuse of children that the world has seen since the Children's Crusade.
The U.S. was intentionally flying over Nagasaki and Hiroshima, not bombing them. They were preserving these two cities, but they were photographing them. And I thought this was an interesting tidbit before we get to what happened with the bomb. that they were actually lulling them into a sense of false security by flying B-29s in these groupings of two and three over the island all the time, so that people got used to seeing the American bombers not bombing them, and therefore they were sort of lulled into complacency.
Yes, and there was there were problems with the bombs, too. One of the most complex issues with the uranium bomb is making sure it doesn't blow up when you don't want it to. And a good shot of flak could have set the bomb off right in the plane, either the uranium bomb or the plutonium bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki.
So they didn't want them shooting up at, they wanted them to stop thinking in terms of trying to fight off the American planes, just wave at them as they go overhead, smile for the camera, but don't worry, and they won't bomb you. What was the feeling, what was the justification that you wrote about where the people in Hiroshima thought there was a reason why they weren't getting bombed? What was that? Do you remember what you said in the book
about... Well, some people convince themselves that there are so many gardens and our city is so beautiful. Some of the biggest gardens in the country are right in and offshore of Hiroshima. And they figured that it was being preserved for that reason. There was one town, I forget the name, but some general decided you don't want to destroy all the beautiful temples and such. So there was one town that was off bounds for bombing, and the only other place that was really off bounds for bombing was the Imperial Palace. They did bomb one whole side of Tokyo and kill 200,000 people in one night with a firebombing, but the palace, you know, they needed to leave the people there so they could be there to surrender.
Now, you said 200,000 people died in one firebombing in Tokyo in one night. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's, how does that correspond to the number of people who were killed by the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, at least before the radiation sickness and all of the other after effects, who were killed in the initial blast? How many people?
No, I think one of the flight engineer on the third plane, the scientific photographic plane, Necessary Evil, Joe Fuco, who passed away last year, he put it in a way I had never expected to hear. And I know Luis Alvarez and Harold Urey, I ended up working with both of them at various times, and they were horrified that the atomic bomb had made nuclear war, that it had made nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons more likely because it was impersonal. You didn't see what it did to people on the ground when you dropped it.
Right.
And Joe Fuco, it's a case where, you know, you talk to the scientists, you get one view, but unless you go out and you do your scientific study and then you come back and you speak to actual firsthand eyewitness participants, archaeology and old, you know, previous discussions or old memoirs can lead you in the wrong direction. Joe Fuco, I wish we could go back in time and tell Alvarez and Urey this. He said, no, they were wrong. It was just the opposite. When we flew over Tokyo or Osaka and we heard 100, 200,000 people were killed, he said, I was on the plane Bad Penny at that time, and I was convinced that I hit those two fuel tanks that my plane was aiming at, and there were 300 other planes that were dropping all those firebombs. So there were a lot of other people to think that they did it. He said Hiroshima was different. When I heard, 70,000 souls, even though it was a smaller initial estimate, 70,000 rather than 200,000, all those souls came back to us.
That's a very interesting way of answering that question, and it'll be the hallmark tonight of this interview with Charles Pellegrino. Always interesting. Thank you. Hang on. We'll get back to why the bomb dropped on Hiroshima was a dud. And as you can hear, Charles Pellegrino has a distinctly scientific view of events, of how we might reconsider what we thought we knew in history. And so we'll talk about the microbiology of the bomb. Also, we'll get to more about the significance of the last train from Hiroshima coming up with Charles Pellegrino. But think about that. Then the guy's saying, you know, well, there was 300 planes dropping bombs. You don't have to take personal responsibility. You could say my bomb hit the weapons depot. But when it was Hiroshima, you knew that it was that one bomb, and that was you, and you got everybody. Just who didn't they get? We'll tell you about that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we get to the core of the story of what happened on that day when the bomb was dropped at 8:15. So much information in this book, The Last Train from Hiroshima. It'll change the way you look at the bombing, as well as whether or not we ever think we want one of these to go off again. For anybody who ever thinks that a tactical nuclear weapon might be a good idea or something that, you know, we could live with, you got to read Last Train from Hiroshima, I think, to get a better perspective on that. May not change your mind, but it will be informative. And we'll start with what happened that day at 8:15, coming up next. 8:15. And one of the most amazing bits of information I've ever heard about the bombing at 8:15 and a clock that had stopped in Hiroshima at that exact time 2 days earlier that seemed to be sending a message about the future. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So we were talking about with Charles Pellegrino, author of The Last Train from Hiroshima, the way it was shaping up, if the bomb was used as soon as it was ready to be used. If the war had been over before the bomb was finished, we wouldn't have dropped it. But it was thought of as another incendiary type device, much like the others that we'd been dropping on the rest of Japan to try to stop them from fighting and to surrender and to finally end, you know, all of World War II. But Charles, and this is the key part, because you kind of hinted at it a little bit earlier, the bomb was barely ready to be dropped on Hiroshima. I mean, they were still tinkering with it to the last second. And in fact, one very unlucky scientist died while adjusting the bomb, correct?
Yeah, I always wondered about a few things. Why Luis Alvarez had put those last three polonium beryllium plugs into the bomb. What those were, there were already four inside around the core. And this was a very, very rare substance. In fact, the whole world's supply, he put at the last minute into the bomb. And I always wondered about that. It's sort of like it wasn't even necessary to use in the first place.
Polonium,
but it was injecting nitrous oxide into a gasoline engine and turning it into a rocket.
Well, explain polonium, because if you're going to go there, then what is it? Why would that not be necessary anyway? And then why there were three rings of polonium in the weapon, and he added four more?
There were four in there, and he added three. And it seemed an unnecessary move.
What does it mean? What did polonium do?
It really donates a lot of neutrons. It's sort of like to the neutron reaction that you're already getting when you slam these masses of uranium-235 together. Basically, they're metals that shed neutrons, and you compress them enough, and they shed a lot, and then you end up with the chain reaction of atoms compressed together and neutrons hitting the cores of atoms, and the whole probability curve just goes off the charts for how many of these reactions you're getting. And in less than 1/1,000,000th of a second, about one-third of a golf ball's volume of a mass equal to about the weight of gold converts instantly to energy, just disappears from the universe and leaves energy in its wake, and you get this tremendous amount of energy all within less than, you know, just a tiny fraction of a lightning bolt's lifespan.
So
the polonium accelerated that.
Right.
But the reason it turns out that he put all of that in there, all the clues were around before, and I knew there had been some sort of accident that was talked about, but I thought they were that it was a reference to someone had it confused with an accident that happened years later at Los Alamos. But there was no question that the Hiroshima bomb went off at only about 10 kilotons, but it had been officially listed at 24 kilotons.
All right. Wait, wait, wait.
Nowhere near that.
I got to stop. You're throwing a lot of stuff
okay.
on the
oh, up. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I know how your mind works.
The bomb went off with about one-third the force that it was supposed to go off with, one-third
okay.
the force of the Nagasaki bomb. It was essentially a dud in spite of all that nuclear nitrous oxide that had been added to a nuclear gas engine, so to say.
And so we're defining dud here, meaning that it had an expectation that it didn't come anywhere near. So it was like a bomb that only partially detonated. And in that way, you're defining it as a dud.
Yes. And okay. Charles Sweeney, who was the one pilot who traveled on both missions, and before getting into his plane, the scientific plane for the Hiroshima mission, he had been informed by Luis Alvarez that the bomb was compromised. He said it would go off. He did not know exactly how much power was going to come from it, but that it was compromised. The final clue came when talking to a flight engineer, Joe Fuoco, and I hadn't mentioned anything to him about the bomb being a dud and being compromised and the polonium plugs or any of that. And I'm sitting and he starts talking to me about the accident at Tinian about 2 days before, and where something went on where there was a neutron surge and people in and near what they called the shack where the bomb was held were affected to varying degrees. Most got better, except for this one scientist who, as near as we can tell, he was doing some sort of adjustment with the part of the mass that was at the aft end of the bomb, these uranium-235 rings, and something happened to create a neutron surge, not enough to melt the uranium completely, but to compromise it. And they brought the scientist, the civilian, as they called them, brought the scientist out, and he did not live till the next morning.
You make the claim that he was dead even as it happened. Even though his
right.
heart didn't stop and his brain was still active, he was dead. How does that
massive
happen?
Massive doses of radiation are a very unusual way to die, especially if you're close to something that's the equivalent of a nuclear accelerator, without any benefit of any shielding at all. Essentially, all protein production in his body would have ceased at that moment. And physically, he's basically dead. His nervous system is starting to shut down. They would have had to carry him out. He would have probably not been able to stand at all. And it just takes the body with those sorts of doses of radiation a while to catch on, for the heart to stop and for the brain to finally stop. The heart's still pumping, but when all protein production, all protein activity just basically comes to a screeching halt, technically you're dead, but you're kind of still able to lay down and talk for a while.
Yeah, and because if you're not producing new protein, if you're not growing, then you're dying. I mean, you can't, your body can go one of two directions.
Yeah, and if enzyme activity is basically shutting down, and it's almost like you're dead already, although to yourself and to others, alive seeming still.
Yeah, it's just tragic. So they get the bomb loaded up, despite the warning that it's compromised. They dropped the bomb on Hiroshima at 8:15. The Enola Gay and two other planes with it. One is the plane that will do the observation in terms of the science, and the other one that's doing the photography. Is that about right?
Yes. The
okay.
Great Artiste and the one Joe Fuoco was on, which was named Necessary Evil.
And so the bomb is dropped at 8:15. Tell the story of the town clock that had stopped a few days earlier.
Right. One woman who survived almost again directly below the bomb in a very thick bank on the ground floor. And she had joked with her friend about how the clock that had stopped and there was, you know, there were no spare military people or anyone, engineers or anyone to fix the clock, but it had stopped at 8:15. And that haunted her, still does. In fact, this one of the women is still alive and haunts her to this day, the 2 days before the atomic bomb stopped, the clock had stopped at 8:15. And that if anyone had repaired the clock, it would only have stopped again at that same moment, just like every other clock in Hiroshima.
Yeah, that it was it almost like something out of a Twilight Zone episode, that the clock stops at the exact minute that everything was going to stop 24 hours later or 48 hours later. And she was one of the survivors. Now, we were talking before about the shock cocoon. And this is really, it's just an amazing telling of the story that you do from the sort of a molecular biological standpoint, using the real physics of what's going on in the last train from Hiroshima, that the bomb drops. At what point, how far above Hiroshima does the bomb go off?
About 1,900 feet, close to 500 meters. It's okay. Set to explode in the sky, and this huge shock bubble forms. The bottom hemisphere of it bellies down, hits the ground, and then uses a rebound effect with compressing air around that hemisphere. And anything outward from the blast zone is just plowed over.
And so it creates a dome of this downward blasting pressure. What's happening within that dome in the second it reaches the ground in Hiroshima?
Well, interestingly, objects, telephone poles, and the classic pictures you see of the Hiroshima dome, that dome-shaped building, if they're right under it, that hemisphere of compressed air can go right past the building. If it can withstand that first almost 200th of a second, it will be like the dome, for example, was somewhat like the nose of a jet aircraft piercing through supersonic wind. And if there were people in some of these buildings that were directly under the bomb, and if they were deep down in the building and shielded from the gamma rays to some degree, they could survive. Right under the bomb, where 1.2 miles away, anyone standing outside, most people inside buildings, they were still within ground zero and did not have a chance if they were in a wooden building, for example.
Right.
That's 1.2 miles away from a dud.
Right. From what is, you know, essentially a dud in terms of what it could have done. How big could the explosion have been if it had only not partially detonated?
Well, we have a perfect example of that at Nagasaki. In fact, that bomb didn't even hit Nagasaki. Charles Sweeney dropped it 2.5 miles upriver, basically in the wrong town, and took out all the military targets anyway. The interesting thing about that bomb, which was not a dud, and most people today think of these bombs as Model T bombs, when actually this is the kind of force that we're looking at with the proliferation that's going on in the world today. The Nagasaki bomb flashed desiccated leaves on trees 50 miles away. It blew people over 20 miles away. 50 miles away, though, those flash desiccated trees are a very scary thing to think about, because had that bomb been dropped somewhere dry, not in very hot and humid Japan, had it been dropped over California during the dry season, or say over the Empire State Building during a drought, or during the fall and when all the leaves are brown on the trees, and say in a very exceptionally dry autumn, it would have created a hurricane of fire 100 miles across, possibly with a hypercane in the center where the Empire State Building is, with a very small tornado of supersonic wind and fire reaching all the way up into the stratosphere.
So that, again, underscores the nature of the dud of Hiroshima, that it did not have anywhere near that kind of devastating effect, although certainly taking nothing away from how devastating it was, and that the bomb, as you describe, and we've all seen the pictures of Hiroshima over the years, and if you haven't, you can go to Google Images, and there's plenty of them there. You were saying about all of the, like, telephone poles and trees and buildings that were left standing straight up, but then just outside of that area, when the blast starts to go outward, everything is knocked over. That's a little bit like what happened in Tunguska,
like
in Russia.
When you have a huge high-altitude blast, things that are pointing right up into it will often survive, especially a tree or a telephone pole. It's like a rocket going through supersonic wind, and objects that are facing the expanding compression wave and the precursor wave that are bulldozed to the side, they'll just plow down for miles and miles in a direction pointing away from the blast.
And that brings us back to the woman you mentioned who survived, who was essentially right underneath the blast, but she survived because she and another woman, they were both very young at the time, were working in a bank, and they were in the vault?
No, they were in the main lobby of the bank, and so they were protected to a great degree by these very thick granite walls. They still had radiation, gamma ray sky shine that was coming in through the windows. And, of course, they stepped out into the black rain once they stepped out into the street. And at that location, a lot of the black rain was the people who had been outside the bank sitting on the steps, whose shadows were on the steps. But they had been disintegrated and irradiated, and the radioactive remnants of those people and objects that had been near the bank were what were coming down with the black rain. And the gamma rays that pierced the building burned them on the inside, and so they immediately became very thirsty, and they found whatever kind of a hat or something they could use for a cup or a can, and they were gathering the black rain and drinking it, never knowing that they were drinking death. They were drinking highly radioactive material.
And yet they survive.
Well, one of them died possibly from a combination of the radiation, but also from the fact that her back had been broken by part of the bank wall exploding, just chunks of granite hitting her in the back.
Right.
And the one woman who survived, again, I cannot explain how she survived because she describes drinking the black rain.
Right.
And this is within the first few minutes after the blast. There were isotopes, the deadliest of them only are dangerous for about 20 minutes or so. But they were drinking this during those first 20 minutes. It's like the chief baker on the Titanic who was swimming around in freezing water for hours and hours and hours. And I don't know how he survived. And then to top all, he did what you never do when he got to the rescue ship. You never want to warm the extremities of your body first. And he had the cook on the Carpathia pop him into an oven to warm him up at low temperature, like one of his own pies, he said. As soon as the heat from his arms reached the heart, he should have been dead from that alone. And it's just somehow there are people who survive impossible things.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the grass people. We'll talk about the ant people coming up after the top of the hour. And we'll talk about the fireworms as you get a better idea of what really happened, both at the atomic level, but also at the very human level in the story of the last train from Hiroshima. And we'll talk about just what that last train was all about with author Charles Pellegrino. Hook up with this book at coasttocoastam.com. You will not regret this read. This is Ian Punnett.